A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about suicidal ideation and depression. What percentage of people with depression actually experience it? What's the clinical distinction between vague thoughts and active planning? And what really happens when you disclose these feelings to a therapist or psychiatrist? He mentions having occasionally had those disappear to a random island, fantasies, and he's wondered whether answering yes to that screening question triggers some kind of straitjacket scenario. The real question underneath is, what's the actual spectrum here, and how does the system actually respond?
This is one of those topics where the gap between public imagination and clinical reality is enormous. And I think it's worth saying up front, the fact that this feels stigmatized even within mental health conversations is itself worth examining. We've done episodes on depression subtypes, on brain changes from therapy, on destigmatization campaigns in different countries. But suicidal ideation is the thing people still whisper about.
The last taboo inside the last taboo.
So let's start with the numbers, because they're higher than most people assume. Depending on which study you look at, somewhere between 50 and 65% of people with major depressive disorder will experience suicidal ideation at some point in their lives. The National Institute of Mental Health data puts lifetime prevalence of ideation among depressed patients at roughly 60%. That's not a fringe symptom, it's more common than not.
Which means we're not talking about some rare extreme, we're talking about something that's almost characteristic of severe depression.
And that reframing matters because it changes how we think about disclosure. If 60% of depressed people have had these thoughts, then a therapist hearing, "Yes, I've had thoughts of not wanting to be here," isn't hearing something unusual. They're hearing something depressingly typical. The World Health Organization's data consistently shows that depression is the leading contributor to suicidal behavior globally, but the ideation piece, the thinking piece, is vastly more common than attempts.
Let's get into the clinical distinction, because the prompt draws this line between the world would be better without me and actually having a plan. What's the actual terminology?
The field distinguishes between passive suicidal ideation and active suicidal ideation. Passive ideation is exactly what the prompt describes. Thoughts like, I wish I could just disappear. I wouldn't mind if I didn't wake up. Everyone would be better off without me. There's a desire for death or disappearance, but no plan, no intent, no method. Active ideation involves thinking about specific methods, making plans, or having intent to act.
The disappear to a random island fantasy that sits where?
That's actually a really interesting edge case. Clinically, that's usually categorized as passive ideation because the core fantasy is escape rather than death. The person isn't imagining being dead. They're imagining being somewhere else, somewhere removed from their current stressors. It's more of an avoidance fantasy with existential coloring. But here's where it gets nuanced. If someone starts researching uninhabited islands, figuring out how to get there, giving away possessions, that shifts toward active ideation because the planning component kicks in.
It's not the content of the fantasy that determines risk level. It's the degree of operationalization.
That's the clinical consensus. And this is where assessment tools like the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale come in. It's not a single yes or no question. A proper clinical assessment walks through, have you wished you were dead? Have you thought about harming yourself? Have you thought about methods? Do you have a plan? Have you made preparations? Have you ever made an attempt? Each step up that ladder represents increased risk and usually triggers different clinical responses.
When the prompt asks, what actually happens if you say yes? The answer is, it depends entirely on which rung of that ladder you're on.
And this is what most people don't understand. Disclosing passive ideation in a therapy session does not trigger an involuntary hold. It doesn't trigger hospitalization. What it triggers is a conversation. The therapist will ask follow-up questions to assess where you are on that spectrum and if you're in the passive range, which the vast majority of disclosures are. The response is typically to integrate that into the treatment plan rather than to escalate.
Let's talk about the involuntary hold scenario, because that's the fear that keeps people silent. What actually triggers it?
The legal standard in most jurisdictions is imminent risk of harm to self or others. It's not enough that someone has thought about suicide. It's not even enough that they have a plan. The threshold is typically that they have intent, a plan, and the means to carry it out in the near future, or that their judgment is so impaired by mental illness that they can't keep themselves safe. A therapist who hospitalizes every patient who mentions passive ideation would be hospitalizing the majority of their depressed patients. That's not how the system works.
Because the system would collapse under the weight of it.
Inpatient psychiatric beds are scarce. In the United States, the number of state psychiatric beds dropped from about 340 per 100,000 people in 1955 to roughly 11 per 100,000 by 2016. You can't hospitalize 60% of depressed patients even if you wanted to. The system is triaged around acute risk.
What does the actual clinical response look like at each level? Walk me through it.
At the passive ideation level, the I wish I could disappear level, the therapist will typically explore what's driving those thoughts, assess whether they're escalating or stable, and work on coping strategies. They might increase session frequency. They'll ask about protective factors, reasons for living, family connections, future plans. They'll usually develop what's called a safety plan, a structured document that lists warning signs, coping strategies, people to contact, and emergency resources. It's collaborative, not coercive.
A safety plan sounds like the clinical equivalent of, here's what to do if this gets worse, rather than, you're a danger to yourself right now.
That's exactly what it is, and research supports it. A study in JAMA Psychiatry found that safety planning interventions in emergency departments were associated with a 45% reduction in subsequent suicidal behavior. It's a practical tool, not a punitive one.
What about at the active ideation level? Someone who has a plan but no immediate intent.
This gets more intensive. The therapist will likely do a more formal risk assessment, possibly involving a psychiatrist if medication needs adjustment. They'll work on restricting access to means. If someone's plan involves medication, they might ask a family member to hold on to prescriptions. They might recommend a partial hospitalization program or intensive outpatient treatment. The goal is to increase support and monitoring without necessarily resorting to inpatient care. Inpatient hospitalization is really reserved for cases where someone has active intent, a plan, access to means, and can't contract for safety. Meaning they can't agree to stay safe between sessions.
Contract for safety. That's the old no harm contract concept.
Which has largely been replaced by safety planning, actually. The no harm contract was a verbal or written agreement that the patient wouldn't harm themselves. The problem is, research showed they don't work particularly well. People in crisis often can't meaningfully commit to that, and it gave clinicians false reassurance. The safety planning approach is more collaborative and practical.
The straitjacket scenario the prompt mentions. That's essentially a Hollywood invention at this point.
I mean, involuntary hospitalization does happen, and we shouldn't minimize that. It can be traumatic. But it's not the response to run-of-the-mill suicidal ideation disclosure. It's the response to an acute crisis where someone is judged to be in imminent danger. And even then, the reality of inpatient psychiatric care in 2026 is not what people imagine from old movies. Restraints are a last resort used for brief periods when someone is actively violent. Most inpatient stays are short, 3 to 7 days on average, focused on stabilization, medication adjustment, and discharge planning.
There's something the prompt touches on that I want to pull out. The idea that someone might answer a screening question positively, but feel ambivalent about what that means. The I've now responded positively to a question of whether I'm having suicidal ideation moment. That's a threshold people cross in a doctor's office, and then immediately wonder if they've made a mistake.
This is a real problem. Screening instruments like the PHQ-9, the patient health questionnaire, which is one of the most widely used depression screening tools, include a single item about thoughts of self-harm. It's item 9, thoughts that you would be better off dead or of hurting yourself in some way. It's scored from 0 to 3 based on frequency over the past 2 weeks. A positive score on that item triggers follow-up, but it's not a suicide risk assessment in itself. The problem is, many patients don't know that, and many primary care physicians aren't well trained in what to do with a positive score.
You're sitting in a primary care office. You check several days on that question because you've been having some dark thoughts, and suddenly the whole appointment changes trajectory.
That's where the stigma piece becomes self-reinforcing. If someone has a negative experience disclosing, if the doctor panics, if they feel judged, if they're sent to the emergency department unnecessarily, they're going to be much less likely to disclose honestly next time. There was actually a study in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry that found a significant percentage of patients who died by suicide had denied suicidal ideation at their last clinical contact. They'd learned to say no.
Which is the worst possible outcome of a system designed to help?
It's the central paradox of suicide prevention. The people who need the most help are often the most skilled at concealing how much help they need. And if the system punishes honesty, even unintentionally, even through clumsiness rather than malice, it trains people to lie.
What should a well-handled disclosure look like?
A well-handled disclosure looks like a clinician who stays calm, who normalizes the experience without minimizing the risk, who asks thoughtful follow-up questions, and who involves the patient in deciding what happens next. The phrase, "Thank you for telling me that," is surprisingly important. It communicates that the disclosure was the right thing to do, not a mistake. Then the clinician should explain what they're doing and why. I'm going to ask you a few more questions to understand what's going on, and then we'll figure out together what kind of support would be helpful.
The together piece seems crucial. The prompt's fear is essentially about losing agency, being locked up, being stripped of control. A good clinical response preserves agency wherever possible.
And this is where the concept of least restrictive care comes in. The ethical principle in mental health is that treatment should be provided in the least restrictive setting that's safe and effective. If someone can be managed with more frequent outpatient visits, you don't hospitalize them. If they can be in a partial hospitalization program, you don't put them in inpatient. The goal is to keep people in their lives, not to remove them from their lives.
Let's go back to the numbers for a moment, because I think there's a distinction that matters. Ideation versus attempts versus completions. What's the ratio?
The lifetime prevalence of suicidal ideation in the general population is estimated at around 9 to 15% depending on the country. Among people with major depressive disorder, as I mentioned, it's 50 to 65%. But the transition from ideation to attempt is much smaller. Roughly one-third of people with ideation will make a plan, and about one-third of those with a plan will make an attempt. So we're talking about maybe 10 to 15% of depressed patients ever making an attempt. And completed suicide is rarer still. Though depression remains the psychiatric condition most strongly associated with suicide, the absolute risk for any given individual is difficult to predict.
The vast majority of people who think about suicide never attempt it, which doesn't mean the thoughts aren't serious or painful, but it does put some context around the risk.
This is why nuanced assessment matters. You can't treat everyone with passive ideation as if they're at imminent risk, because they're not. But you also can't dismiss passive ideation, because for a subset of people, it does escalate. The clinical challenge is identifying who's in that subset.
What are the escalation warning signs?
One is the transition from vague thoughts to specific thoughts. From, "I wish I could disappear," to, "I've been thinking about how I would do it." Another is increased preoccupation. The thoughts move from occasional to daily to hourly. Another is the acquisition of means, suddenly buying something that could be used. Another is what clinicians call preparatory behaviors, giving away possessions, writing a note, saying goodbye in ways that feel final. And then there's a paradoxical sign that's really important, sudden calm. Someone who's been deeply agitated and then suddenly seems peaceful. That can indicate they've made a decision and feel relief about it.
That's the one that catches families off guard.
It's devastating because loved ones often interpret the calm as improvement. They think the person is finally feeling better, when in fact they've resolved to end their life and the cognitive dissonance has lifted.
Let's talk about how to broach this topic with a friend, because the prompt raises that too. Someone's worried about a friend, doesn't know how to bring it up. What's the evidence-based approach?
The evidence is clear on this. Asking someone directly about suicidal thoughts does not increase their risk. It doesn't plant the idea. It doesn't make things worse. Multiple studies have confirmed this. In fact, asking directly can reduce distress. It signals that someone cares enough to ask the hard question, and it gives the person permission to talk about something they may have been carrying alone.
The fear that if I ask, I might put the idea in their head is not just wrong, it's counterproductive.
The question that tends to work best is direct and non-judgmental. Something like, sometimes when people are going through what you're going through, they have thoughts of ending their life. Have you been having thoughts like that? You're not asking. You're not thinking of hurting yourself, are you? Which communicates that the right answer is no. You're opening a door.
If they say yes?
Then you listen. You don't try to talk them out of it. You don't say, but you have so much to live for. You don't minimize. You say something like, thank you for telling me, or that sounds really hard. Then you ask if they have a plan, if they've thought about how they would do it. If they have a plan and intent, you help them get to emergency services. If they're in the passive ideation range, you might help them connect with a therapist or call a crisis line together. The key is to stay present and not panic.
There's a weird social dynamic where the person asking is often more uncomfortable than the person being asked. The person with ideation has been living with these thoughts. They're not new to them. The friend is the one having the novel experience.
That's a really astute observation. And it's why training matters. Programs like QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer, and ACEST, Applied Suicide Intervention Skills, training, exist precisely to help people get comfortable with that discomfort. They teach ordinary people to have these conversations without freezing up or saying the wrong thing.
Let's shift to the treatment side. If someone is in therapy and discloses ideation, what actually changes about their treatment? Do certain therapies handle this better than others?
Some therapies specifically target suicidal ideation. Dialectical Behavior Therapy, DBT, was originally developed for borderline personality disorder but has strong evidence for reducing suicidal behavior across diagnoses. It teaches distress tolerance, emotion regulation, and interpersonal effectiveness. Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Suicide Prevention, CBT, SPC, specifically targets the thought patterns that lead to suicidal crises. And there's a newer approach called CAMS, the Collaborative Assessment and Management of Suicidality, which treats suicidality as the primary treatment target rather than treating it as a symptom of depression that will resolve when the depression resolves.
That's an interesting distinction, treating the suicidality directly rather than hoping it goes away when the depression lifts.
It's a paradigm shift. For a long time, the assumption was that if you treat the depression, the suicidal thoughts will follow. But research has shown that suicidal ideation can have its own trajectory. It doesn't always track with depression severity. Some patients' depression improves, but the suicidal thoughts persist. Others have suicidal thoughts that come and go independently of their mood. CAMS addresses this by making suicidality the central focus, using a collaborative approach where the clinician and patient work together to understand what's driving the suicidal thoughts and develop strategies specific to them.
The collaborative piece comes up again. It seems like the thread running through all the effective approaches is treating the patient as a partner rather than a problem to be managed.
That's where the stigma piece becomes clinically relevant. When someone feels ashamed of their suicidal thoughts, they're less likely to engage collaboratively. They're more likely to hide, to minimize, to disengage from treatment. Destigmatizing suicidal ideation isn't just a social justice project, it's a clinical necessity.
What about medication, antidepressants, and the black box warning? That's a whole conversation.
The FDA black box warning on SSRIs for young adults, the one about increased risk of suicidal thinking, has been controversial since it was introduced in 2004. The concern was that in the initial weeks of treatment, some patients experience increased agitation or activation before the mood benefits kick in, and that window can be dangerous. The data is complicated. Some studies found a small increase in suicidal ideation among young adults starting antidepressants. Other studies found that the reduction in suicide rates as SSRI prescriptions increased suggests a net protective effect. The current consensus is that the risk is real but small, and that the benefits of treatment generally outweigh it, but it requires monitoring, especially in the first few weeks.
Which loops back to the assessment conversation. If someone's starting an antidepressant and they already have passive ideation, the clinician needs to be tracking whether those thoughts are intensifying.
The patient needs to know that this is something to watch for. Informed consent means saying this medication might help, and it might also make things feel worse before they feel better. Here's what to look for, and here's who to call if that happens.
The prompt mentions having been really concerned about a friend and not knowing how to broach the topic. I want to linger on the friend piece for a moment, because not everyone has a therapist. Most people's first point of contact when they're struggling is a friend or family member.
Which makes the friend's role enormously important and enormously under-supported. There's something called the gatekeeper model in suicide prevention, training people in community roles like teachers, clergy, bartenders, and just ordinary friends to recognize warning signs and connect people to care. The evidence for gatekeeper training is mixed, but the logic is sound. You can't rely on people self-referring to mental health care because depression itself reduces help-seeking behavior. The people around them need to be the bridge.
Being a bridge is different from being a therapist. A friend doesn't need to fix anything. They need to listen, stay calm, and help the person get to professional support.
The friend's job is not to solve the problem. It's to stay connected and facilitate the next step. Sometimes that's as simple as saying, I don't know exactly how to help, but I'm going to stay here with you while we figure it out.
There's something almost sacred about that, bearing witness without needing to resolve.
It's hard. It's really hard. People want to fix things. Sitting with someone else's pain without trying to make it go away is a skill, and most people haven't practiced it.
Let's address something. The prompt doesn't ask directly, but that's hovering around the edges. The I'd love to disappear to a random island fantasy. The prompt frames it as relatively benign, a coping mechanism for transient stress. But is there a version of that fantasy that's more concerning?
The distinction is usually about function. If the fantasy serves as a mental escape hatch that helps someone get through a stressful day and then re-engage with their life, it's probably adaptive. It's a coping mechanism. If the fantasy becomes more appealing than actual life, if the person starts withdrawing from relationships and responsibilities because the fantasy world is preferable, that's more concerning. And if the disappear fantasy shifts from escape to somewhere to cease to exist, that's the clinical boundary being crossed.
The cease to exist formulation is interesting because it's distinct from wanting to die. Some people don't want the experience of dying. They just want the experience of being alive to stop.
That's passive ideation in its purest form. It's not, I want to kill myself. It's, I want the pain to stop, and I can't see any other way for that to happen. That's actually a really important clinical distinction because it points toward what the person actually needs, relief from suffering, not death per se.
Which suggests that interventions focused on reducing suffering, improving sleep, reducing isolation, treating physical pain, addressing financial stress, might reduce ideation even if they don't directly target the suicidal thoughts.
This is exactly what the research on needs-based approaches shows. Addressing the drivers of suffering. Housing instability, chronic pain, social isolation, financial stress can reduce suicidal ideation more effectively than talking about suicide in the abstract. The thoughts are often a response to conditions, not a free-floating symptom.
We've covered the spectrum from passive ideation to active planning, the clinical response at each level, what actually happens when you disclose, how to talk to a friend, and what treatments exist. I want to close the loop on something the prompt mentions. The fear of the straitjacket, the fear of being locked up. How much of that fear is grounded in actual contemporary practice versus historical reality?
The historical reality is that psychiatric care was once genuinely terrifying. Through the mid-20th century, involuntary commitment was common, conditions in asylums were often horrific, and patients had few rights. The deinstitutionalization movement of the 1960s and 70s was a response to real abuses. But deinstitutionalization brought its own problems. Inadequate community-based care, the criminalization of mental illness, the rise of homelessness among people with severe mental illness. The system we have now is fragmented and under-resourced, but it's not the system of the 1950s. Involuntary commitment is legally constrained, time-limited, and subject to judicial review. It can still be traumatic, and we shouldn't minimize that, but the straitjacket scenario is largely a cultural memory rather than a contemporary reality.
Cultural memory is a good way to put it. The image is so powerful that it persists even when the practice doesn't.
That image keeps people from seeking help. That's the real harm. Someone who needs to tell their therapist they're having suicidal thoughts doesn't, because they're picturing a padded room, and they end up managing a crisis alone that could have been managed collaboratively.
The most practical thing we can say in an episode like this is, if you're having passive thoughts about not wanting to be here, you are in the majority of people with depression, not some extreme outlier, and telling a competent clinician will not result in you losing your freedom. It will result in a conversation.
If you're worried about a friend, ask directly. You're not going to make it worse. You might be the first person who's ever given them permission to say it out loud.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The oldest surviving Islamic world map created by the Persian geographer Al-Istakri in the 10th century measures just 34 by 22 centimeters and places the Arabian Peninsula at the exact center of the known world, a cartographic choice that influenced Islamic map-making for over 400 years.
34 centimeters. That's basically a placemat.
A very geopolitically significant placemat.
This has been My Weird Prompts with me, Korn, and my brother, Herman Poppleberry, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.